You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNADS.com.
Happy New Year. This is Rohit Bhargava, author of Non-Obvious 2017, How to Think Different, Curate Ideas, and Predict the Future. And you're listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, which was named by LinkedIn as one of 10 podcasts that will make you a better marketer. My goal for this podcast is to help you discover new ideas about what's actually working in modern marketing. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything discussed in this episode's show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com. Also, if you're listening to the show right now, and you're not driving or operating dangerous machinery, please send me a tweet and tell me where in the world you're listening from. My Twitter handle is @MarketingBook. Today, we're joined by Rohit Bhargava, and we're going to talk about his book, Non-Obvious 2017 Edition, How to Think Different, Curate Ideas, and Predict the Future. Rohit Bhargava is a trend curator who believes in sharing non-obvious ideas. He's the author of 5 best-selling business books, including Non-Obvious and Lycanomics. Rohit has advised hundreds of global brands as a former executive at Ogilvy and is currently founder of the Influential Marketing Group, an independent strategic consulting practice based in Washington, D.C. A popular and non-boring keynote speaker, Rohit has been invited to headline events in over 30 countries where his popular talks have inspired audiences from 10 to 10,000 people to lead with personality, create more human organizations, and even learn how to predict the future. His blog has been named one of the top 25 marketing blogs in the world by Ad Age magazine. Rohit also teaches marketing at Georgetown University and is regularly quoted in the Harvard Business Review, The Guardian, NPR, and now the Marketing Book Podcast. He is a lifelong fan of anything having to do with the Olympics. He's been to 4 so far. And he actively avoids anything having to do with cauliflower and has dedicated his career to helping brands and leaders be more influential by embracing their humanity and personality. And according to his website, his LinkedIn profile, and everyone else I've spoken to, he's a really nice guy. Rohit, congratulations on Non-Obvious 2017 and welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you. Thanks, Douglas. Thanks for having me.
So I should mention that I recently saw your book mentioned on the Content Marketing Institute blog, and it was their holiday gift guide before the holidays, the most significant content marketing books published during 2017. A great, great list, and I've had a few of the other authors on the show. Did you happen to see that you made it onto a holiday gift guide?
I did. And, you know, anybody who releases a book in December, you definitely want to be on the holiday gift guide. So it was great. It was nice of Roger to include me on that.
Yes, Roger Parker. So let me start with a quote from the book and we'll be off to the races here. This book was inspired by the landslide of obvious ideas we see published today. In a world where anyone is one button away from being a self-declared expert, learning to think differently is more important than ever. Observing and curating ideas can lead to a unique understanding of why people choose to buy, sell, or believe anything. This book aims to teach you the skills to avoid the obvious and see the ideas, patterns, and trends that others miss. So, Rohit, can you tell the listener about the story of how this whole non-obvious trend series came to be and how far back it goes?
Yeah, it's for me, it's been a journey of about 7 years. So I did my first trend report in 2011 in a very different format. It was a visual PowerPoint presentation with 15 slides. That's how it started. And my motivation was just to create a great year-end blog post that a lot of people would look at. And it definitely succeeded with that. Got a lot of views. It got a lot of attention, so much so that I said in 2012, I should probably do this again. So I did it a second year. It was a little bit longer. And before realizing it, I kind of turned it into an annual thing. 2013, it became a lot longer. It was 120 slides instead of 10 and 15. And basically what happened was I had more examples. I had more insights behind the trends. I started to broaden focus beyond marketing and go into other categories in 2014. And 2015 was kind of my big year with this. And what I mean by that is I started not just publishing trends, but also talking about what it takes to predict these trends and learn those skills for yourself. And so that was the year where it came out in hardcover as a full-length book. And half of the book was dedicated to the techniques of being what I called a trend curator instead of a trend spotter and what the difference was. And the second half was, here are the 15 trends for 2015. And that book hit the Wall Street Journal bestseller list, and then everything kind of exploded from there. And since then, I've been doing annual updates. And so right now, the 2017 version is just coming out, and that is 15 trends that are going to change business in the coming year.
Great. So what is the difference between trend spotting versus trend curating?
So a lot of times when people describe trend spotting, they say, let's find an interesting idea somewhere. So a great example of that is I saw a story of a Starbucks in Malaysia that was hiring deaf baristas. And it was just this great example of being inclusive in hiring and letting people be great at their job, even though they happen to have a disability. And to me, that was the perfect example of what we think about with trend spotting, which is, let me spot an idea. And then the easy thing to say is, okay, well, the trend is deaf baristas, right? But that doesn't really make sense because there's only one example of that. And I think a lot of times what happens is lazy trend prediction finds one example and says, this is a trend. And instead, what trend curation does, and what I think the difference is trend curation is all about finding lots of examples of something and then elevating what it means to something bigger. So the deaf baristas in Starbucks wouldn't be an example of everybody's hiring deaf people, but it would be an example of maybe inclusive human resources or inclusive hiring. And so the trend has to be something bigger than that. And that was what inspired me to kind of start writing about trends in the first place, that I was just seeing a lot of this lazy thinking. And I was traveling a lot at the time, and I realized that the way people collected ideas and used them for trends was exactly the opposite to how they were collecting frequent flyer miles.
Right, right. Well, let's say more about that. Why are most trend predictions, as you say in the book, spectacularly useless?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons, but the main one is it's just lazy. I mean, they find one example of something and then they say this is a trend, or they declare something that exists as a trend. So a couple of years ago, it was 3D printing is a trend. And I wrote about that and I said, look, 3D printing is something that exists, but a trend has to be describing our behavior. So the makers movement is a trend, or was a trend and still kind of is. And 3D printing is one element of that. But to call 3D printing itself a trend or Snapchat a trend is just lazy. And that's what I wanted to get away from, because everybody's heard of these things and nobody really thinks about them in an elevated way. And the frequent flyer thing for me was you spend months or sometimes even years gathering frequent flyer miles, and then eventually you cash them all in for that one trip or that one ticket. And with ideas, we seem to think we should do the exact opposite. We find an idea and then we have to figure out a way of using it right away. Otherwise, we forget about it and we write it down on a scrap of paper and then we lose the paper. And for me, it was, how do I introduce more discipline around my process of gathering ideas so that a year later, after I've written something down, I can go back, I can look at it, I can match it up with an intersection of an existing idea or an interesting idea in a totally different industry, make those connections, and then figure out what the trends are. And that's really the secret of the process that I use.
Yeah, it's explained in the book in great detail. And my impression is, what else do you do? Because it seems like this never stops.
You know, it's sort of like anything that becomes a habit for you. Once it becomes a habit, you kind of do it unconsciously without even realizing it. And so I have a little notebook that kind of looks a little bit like a passport that I keep in my pocket at all times. And I take notes in that notebook. I tear articles out of magazines and just stick them in my bag to save for later. And all of these things that I'm doing to gather these ideas at, you know, 50 plus events that I go to every year, or as part of client engagements, or just reading things that I see, the discipline around that helps me to have so much content But I also am really good about not dwelling on any one of those things. So I'll literally save an idea from a magazine about something really interesting, but I don't exactly know what it means. But I don't spend too much time trying to figure out what it means in that moment, because when I go back at the end of the year and I start pulling all this stuff together for my trend report, then I start to analyze it.
So when you see, I got the impression, maybe it was just me, Rohit, but when I read the book, there are a lot of people that are using the word trend. And as you mentioned, they're not really trends. And I'm wondering, what are the things that make you pull your hair out the most? What are some of the greatest myths of trend prediction?
I think the first one is that you have to be some sort of a Juilliard-trained futurist in order to be able to see trends. And I think that we overestimate the importance of expertise, and in particular, industry expertise. And one of the things that people notice right away about my trend predictions is that they are not based on industries. So I don't have 5 retail trend predictions. I don't have 5 financial services trend predictions. Instead, I use much broader categories. I use economics and entrepreneurship. I use consumer behavior. I use media and entertainment and education. And so, like, you know, these are kind of broad things that could apply to multiple categories. And for me, that allows me to elevate from some of the lazier trend predictions that we see out there. So the first thing that I teach people when I do workshops and things is anybody can learn these skills. And I have a great slide that I use from the Pixar film Ratatouille. And, you know, if your listeners have seen that film, it's all about the rat who isn't supposed to be a cook, because, you know, who wants a rat in a kitchen? But
unless it's cooking,
he learns how to cook. Yeah, right. Exactly. And unless it's cooking beautiful French food. Right?
Yeah.
But the whole idea is, like, anyone can cook. That's the sort of tagline of the movie. And I believe that about trends, that if anyone learns the right techniques, anybody can teach themselves how to do this.
So the name of the book, Non-Obvious, what's the difference between an obvious trend and a non-obvious trend? Maybe you could talk about the things that actually make up a trend.
Yeah. So for me, I look for 3 things when it comes to identifying a trend. I look for an idea that I can describe in a quantifiable way. I look for it having an impact in terms of the behavior of people, so the decisions people make or the business models of companies and what companies are doing. And I look for acceleration. So is it having more of an impact as time goes on? And the intersection of those 3 things lead me towards a trend. And the non-obvious part of it really forces me to have more discipline about coming up with new original ideas versus things that everybody's talking about. So if you look back at some of the previous trends that I've done, I mean, there was a moment that many of your listeners probably remember where everyone was talking about big data, and that was the new thing. And right in that moment, I published a trend called small data. And the whole idea was to take the opposite look at what really granular specific data versus large data sets that everybody was having struggles and challenges analyzing could mean, and what the value of that might be. And it sort of flipped the idea from company-owned big data to individually generated small data. And that, to me, is one of the ways of thinking about this, that if everybody's thinking about something in one way, the non-obvious angle has to be, how do I add a layer or a nuance that is still important, but that most people aren't talking about?
Yeah. And you know how when you go on Amazon, you'll see like a book and it'll say, people who bought this also bought this?
Yeah.
Here's my prediction. It's going to be this book, and it's going to be Martin Lindstrom's book, Small Data.
Yeah.
Great book. And you talk about it in yours. And he was on the podcast. And, you know, one of my takes on his book was that marketers are too obsessed, too reliant on this big data. And they use it to use an expression that David Ogilvy once used. See what I did there? Mm-hmm. He said that a lot of marketers are using big data like a drunk uses a lamp post, more for support than for illumination. And in his book, Martin Lindstrom talks about how you've got this data, but you've got to go tie it all together. So I thought there were some very similar aspects of both.
Yeah, he's got a great point of view. And I loved his book, Small Data. And it came out, I think it was the year after I had used small data as one of the trends that I put in the non-obvious report, but it took a different angle to it that was very specifically his. And what I loved about the angle that he took around small data, and his whole premise was, when I say data as a word to you or to your listeners, many people immediately think of spreadsheets. And his point is that there is lots of data to be generated from observation. And that's what he spends his whole day and year doing. I mean, I think he spent something crazy like 300 nights a year or something like that on the road, right? And
I interviewed him from a hotel room.
Yeah, of course, because you know he goes and lives in people's houses and does that. I mean, it's his lifestyle to do that, right? But he really understands people in a way that most people never will, because they just don't spend as much time directly engaging with them as him. I mean, his life is one macro global focus group.
Fascinating, and the book was kind of written like a thriller, and then at the very end, he explained what happened. So let's jump into some of the trends that you talk about. There's several on here. We won't have time for all of them, but I wanted to ask about Desperate Detox, which you originally curated in 2014. Can you explain that for the listener?
Yeah. So the first thing to explain, I think, is why did I come back to it after I'd already curated it in the past? And I only do that for some trends, a small percentage of trends. And to me, this one was originally curated in 2014, and it was all about how we need time away from our technology and how we're trying to escape our cell phones and we're just trying to switch off. And 2 years later, this trend actually became a lot bigger than that. And so I brought it back. And when I brought it back, what I talked about in the trend was that we are seeking simplicity from clutter in many ways. And sometimes that clutter is based on technology and too much technology in front of us. But then you look at like the huge success of Marie Kondo's book, The Life-Changing Art of Tidying Up, and this whole idea of like, let's simplify our lives, let's own less stuff. Let's watch. There's a really interesting TV series that Netflix optioned from Norway called Slow TV, where it's literally 12 hours of a log burning in a fireplace. And you just turn it on and it's just background sort of stuff. But it's got a simplicity that allows people to slow down in a way that they are often looking for. And so this was just a fascinating evolution of a trend that caused me to then bring it back and talk about it.
And it resonated with me, as I'm sure it would with a lot of listeners, where in the last couple of weeks, I did something that's had a big impact, which is I removed Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn from my phone.
Yep.
And I am just amazed at the difference it's made. I mean, there's still plenty of time to look at it and all that type of thing. And made me think of Nir Eyal's book, Hooked, where he explains how these addictive products are made. And I'm thinking, well, yep, that definitely applies to this listener, the need to detox.
Yeah. I mean, you think about like, you know, what Weight Watchers or any of those folks say about losing weight is the best way to avoid having ice cream is to not buy any in the first place and put it in your house.
Right.
And I think your idea, your sort of adoption of this idea around removing that stuff from your phone is one extreme way totally of doing it. Some people would maybe like, well, I can't do that. But, you know, the kind of baby step towards that is turn off all your notifications. You might get new stuff on Facebook or anywhere else, but you don't get a notification every time that happens. And so for me, I have every notification turned off on my phone except for the notifications for flights, because you know I want those when I'm traveling, and text messages. And other, because I don't get a huge volume of text messages, but when I do, it's usually something urgent.
Yeah, it might be the wife, and you better not miss that message.
That is exactly right. That's got to be prioritized.
Yeah. So, well, also, I had read this article recently from Ryan Holiday about how from the recent election, how all the news was kind of bringing him down. And he did the same thing where he removed some of these things from his phone and made a big difference. So I thought I'd give it a try. And sure enough, I was just surprised. So let's go on to a couple of the ones that are really specifically about marketing and social media. Can you explain this idea of passive loyalty and the implication for marketers about earning real loyalty? And I guess there's a big misunderstanding of what loyalty really is.
There really is. And if you look at the normal things that people think about when it comes to loyalty programs for companies, so things like loyalty cards and membership points and things like that, what you realize is a vast majority of people, I think it's something like, you know, 80% of people are only really active in a couple of the loyalty programs that they have. And even then, they don't use it in terms of redeeming things as often as you would think. And so there's all of this messaging that the industry is trying to put out there saying, hey, you got all these points, don't forget to use them. You know, so if you get any of those things in the mail that say you have 7,000 frequent flyer points, did you want to get these magazines that you'll never read with those points? You know, that's an attempt at saying, hey, you got some points and they have some value. And as long as you cash in on them, you feel like there's value. So you stay part of the program. And passive loyalty to me, like what really got me thinking about it was the Amazon Dash button. Because when the Amazon Dash button came along, if most of your listeners are familiar with it, it was Amazon's chance to get into the home and literally create a button that would allow you to reorder stuff like toilet paper and paper towels and stuff like that.
So like in your washroom, you'd have one of these little buttons and you'd press it when you need to order more. I don't have one.
And it was connected. Yeah, exactly. And it was connected to Wi-Fi and it would just automatically place the order on Amazon. And people in retail industries where they were these buttons started panicking because the idea was if Bounty has the Dash button in your house, then for the next 6 months, you only buy Bounty. And that to me was the perfect way of thinking about loyalty, which is the immediate thing you think is, oh, wow, Bounty's now got a loyal customer for 6 months. But the thing is, that person really doesn't have any loyalty to Bounty. That just happens to be the button that they have. And as soon as they stop using it or as soon as they move on to something else, they'll switch immediately. And that was, to me, the example of passive loyalty that we often think about and say, oh, we've got a loyal customer because they've placed six orders in a row. And so therefore, they're loyal. When actually, it's more like what the cell phone business knows, which is you might be loyal today, but then T-Mobile comes along and says, we'll give you a brand new phone and we'll pay you $800 to swish your phone. And you say, okay, thanks. And you move.
Yeah.
And that's not something loyal customers do.
And this is what you call the loyalty of convenience.
Yeah. Yes. And there's different reasons why people may seem like they're loyal, but they actually aren't, right? So there may be a loyalty of price. And so, you know, as soon as the price changes, the loyalty goes away. There may be loyalty of convenience. So you go to the same place because it just happens to be closer or on your way home from work. And so it's just about convenience beyond anything else. But the nuance there is marketers have to get much better at understanding, okay, these 100 people, for example, that we think are loyal, how many of them are passively loyal versus actively loyal? And actively loyal are the brand champions. They're the ones who love the brand, who when somebody posts something negative, they are immediately up in arms on your behalf. If someone gave them a better offer, they'd say, thanks, but no thanks. That's the type of customer that every brand wants, but that's only a segment of loyalty.
Yeah, and you describe that as the loyalty of belief versus the loyalty of convenience. Very interesting. And also, you said one great line from the book was, satisfied customers are not the same as loyal customers.
Yes, that's right.
So another one is authentic fame seekers. I want you to explain that. And there was one line where you said, Kim Kardashian has the ultimate skill, which is a willingness to offer an extreme version of personality and authenticity directly to fans. So through that lens, can you explain this concept of authentic fame seekers?
Yeah, I think the thing that will tell you the most about this trend is the duality of the title. And I spent a lot of time thinking about what I was going to call this trend, as I do with all of the trends. And I have a background in English literature and poetry. And so this whole naming thing for me is a very deep process of trying to figure out the exact right words to name a trend. And if I said something was authentic, you would generally think that's a positive thing. And if I described someone as a fame seeker, you would see that as a negative thing. And the fact that I put these together, I think, tells you a lot about this trend, that there's a duality behind the trend of these people want to be famous, the ones who are creating these amazing YouTube accounts and driving millions of views, and Kim Kardashian as sort of the champion of this personality type. But at the same time, they want to tell you about themselves in a truly authentic, real way that most people don't. I mean, they take photos of themselves in their house with their own phone, wearing their own stuff at home. Like, it's not staged in the way that we often think about it. I mean, there is some staging there. And of course, Kim Kardashian's like putting on her makeup and doing all this stuff to look hot in her photos because that's what she's selling. But at the same time, like, she's comfortable with sharing more about herself than most of us would be. And that's a form of authenticity. You may not appreciate it or agree with it, but you can't disagree that that's a level of authenticity that most of us just aren't willing or open to share.
It's very interesting, and it brings to mind other reality TV, like the lure of that.
Yeah, it has a lure on multiple levels, right? I mean, we want to see people doing things that we can't or won't do ourselves. That's one thing. We want to see things, and where reality TV has really succeeded is in understanding this raw human emotion to want to feel better about yourself when comparing yourself to people who have serious emotional or personality issues. And, you know, you watch some of these things on The Bachelor or like any of these shows, and after watching that, you think to yourself, man, I'm really well adjusted and nice compared to these people.
It's like watching Cops.
Yeah, right. And, you know, and I think the psychology of that's probably pretty easy to describe and explain, right? I mean, we all want to feel a little better about ourselves. And if watching people do dumb things in contrived situations helps us feel that, then you're going to get an audience for that.
Yeah. Well, I can't enjoy reality TV like most people, unfortunately. Plus, we don't have cable or satellite. I can understand how it's very appealing. Next one, you talk about lovable unperfection, and you talk about embrace your flaws, and flawed is different than broken, and that marketers should make flaws a selling point. Can you explain this lovable unperfection, which is also originally curated in 2014?
Yeah, this one is one that just keeps coming up in so many different ways. So you've got products like UGG boots or Crocs that are on any level, on any objective level, completely ugly, badly designed products from a visual point of view. And yet people love them because of their comfort or because of their kind of iconic nature and how people feel about them. And so you have products like that, which are kind of odd, but loved because they're odd. But then you also have this idea of people believing in someone or something more because it's more human and willing to show its flawed side. So if you think about the end of every Jackie Chan movie, right, where you watch Jackie Chan do these amazing stunts and everything in the movie, and then at the end, you have these outtakes, and the outtakes show him screwing up. They show him like slamming into a wall or getting carted away by the ambulance and all of the work that goes in and the fact that he screwed it up probably hundreds of times before he got it to that one take that you see in the movie. And that gives you a whole different appreciation for him and who he is and how hard he works. And to me, that is lovable imperfection. Not the guy who does the stunt perfectly and you see it in the movie and you're like, there's no way that's real. But the guy who you see crash into the wall five times and get carted off on an ambulance, and so therefore you appreciate what he's able to do in the film much more.
And Rohit, I'd like the 30 minutes back that I spent watching the Jackie Chan outtakes while reading your book. But it was
you're going to go back and look at those.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, we'll have to include a link to some in the show notes just to pass on this joy and time wasting to the listener. But it was,
I'm sure someone's done a YouTube
trust me, they're there. I was watching them. So it's interesting because in a recent interview with Dr. Philip Kotler about his latest book, Marketing 4.0, he talks about a very similar thing where brands need to be less intimidating, and that in this high-tech world, the more human you can be, the more of a differentiation it's going to be from a marketing standpoint.
Well, you definitely know how to make a marketing guy feel good. I mean, to be in the same sentence with him is is a nice honor.
Well, so. I was excited when I saw it in both, and I'm thinking, wow, yeah, okay, I get it. But I guess somebody could have told me that, but until I read both your book and his, I didn't see it the same way. So yeah, it's kind of an eye-opening thing for me. I have to ask you, back to lovable imperfection, though, you talk about you have to be willing to fail publicly in order to build trust. Can you tell the listener about the Hans Brinker Budget Hotel? I'd never heard of it.
Yeah, the Hans Brinker Budget Hotel.
And have you stayed at it?
I have been to it, but I haven't stayed at it. And that was not because I didn't want to, but because when I was in Amsterdam, somebody had already kind of booked me somewhere else and they were covering it. So I wasn't going to switch that to stay in a hostel just for fun.
Right.
But the Hans Brinker Budget Hotel is a unique place in Amsterdam that has spent the last decade, actually more than a decade, promoting how bad it actually is. So all of their marketing and advertising focuses on how awful the experience is of staying there, how you're unlikely to survive, how, you know, the best upside they can offer of staying there is that your immune system will be dramatically improved because it's so dirty. I mean, there's, you know, just tons and tons of amazingly beautiful visual ads talking about this. And I raise that as kind of this ultimate curiosity. I mean, why would a hotel brand promote how awful it is? But then you think about who their audience is, and it's generally backpackers going through Europe who don't have a lot of money for luxury. And the number one thing they're looking for is a great story to be able to share with their friends and family. And what could be a better story than staying in the worst hotel in the world and surviving? And also, you know, because all their promotion focuses on that, a consumer's expectation is rock bottom when they get there. And so the only place to go from there is up. So when you actually give them a bed with a pillow, they're thrilled. And everyone leaves saying, oh, that wasn't as bad as they said it was going to be. And so they win for that too.
Yeah, I could just, it made me think of an airline that their slogan could be, we'll get you there.
Yeah, we'll get you there and you'll have a seat.
Yeah.
What else do you want?
Now be quiet. Because let's be honest, that's the experience we get already to a certain extent. Even though our friends that work at the airlines are doing their best to make it pleasant for us, it's still tough. Two other things I wanted to ask you about. One was the trend of deep diving. Can you explain that and what the implications are there for particularly for marketing and marketing content?
Yeah, I think the shortest way of describing it is this commonly used acronym of TLDR, too long didn't read, which perfectly kind of sums up this idea that our attention spans are shrinking and we don't want to read anything anymore and we're unwilling to spend any sort of time with media and we share things on Facebook without even reading it first, which is kind of a major reason in this past election cycle where you had all this fake news coming out because people didn't really take any time to see whether it was real or not. They just kind of shot it out there.
Wait a minute. If it's on the internet, it's true, right?
That is what we hope, but is never correct, right?
You heard it here first, folks.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Education and entertainment. That's what we get right here. But deep diving for me was sort of shifting the acronym from too long didn't read to too interesting read later, which is a behavior that more and more people are exhibiting with the stuff that they really want to consume. So much so that you've got Wired magazine has a section of their website called wired.com/longreads. And it is specifically for when you want to read a nicely written, in-depth journalistic article about something interesting and you have some time to do that. Maybe you're waiting for a train. Maybe you're kind of in a boring meeting where you can kind of sneak your phone out. Whatever the moment happens to be, there are plenty of moments in time where we as consumers of media want to deep dive into something. And the smart media organizations are making that easier for us to do with some of their content on demand for us. I mean, Netflix just announced that you'll be able to download films now and watch them offline, which is a big deal. And I don't know how much of the content is included in that, but this idea of like us wanting this content on demand is the flip side of what has been happening for many, many years now around media becoming more and more glanceable, which was a trend I had like 2 years ago for glanceable media, which is just if I don't get in on a glance, I'm not interested. And now I think we're evolving to be a little bit, I mean, this is a sign of hope that deep diving even exists.
Yeah. And when I read that, I thought of two things. One is the Pocket app where you're reading something online and you can click the Pocket button like in your Chrome toolbar and it saves it to that Pocket service. So then I can come back to it when I'm ready for that. Kind of like what you're describing with Wired. And also on Facebook, you can save a link. So in other words, I'll see something like I recently saw another monster how-to article from Neil Patel. And I just, yep. I click save because it's like, well, I can't get to that now, but I definitely want to dig into it later. So it was interesting. Maybe it helped me understand why I'm doing certain things.
Yeah, and if you look at highly analytical guys like Neil, for example, I mean, one of the things you'll realize that they quietly shifted on their blog is a lot of their long, in-depth blog posts don't even have dates on them anymore. You know, so the whole thing with a blog was, of course, you would have a date against every blog post. And now that's kind of going out the window, because if you have a long article on how to create the perfect headline for a Facebook post, do you really need a date on that? Or is that just evergreen?
Well, and not only that, it's evergreen, but he's going to go back and update it.
Right, exactly. You know, which makes it even more evergreen.
Yeah, and it's also another reason why you – well, there's other reasons why you don't see blog comments increasingly, but that's yet another one. Because a lot of the discussions on social media now anyway versus the blog comments. Last one from this one, the 2017. Explain what precious print is. Seems counterintuitive.
Yeah, precious print is basically describing the fact that we – see and hold less things in print, but when we do, it feels more precious to us. And I think the perfect example of that is if you have printed a photo at any point in the last 6 months. I mean, maybe you even haven't, but if you have, chances are it was a photo that felt more precious to you. It wasn't every photo. We don't do that anymore. We don't get every photo from a trip printed, most people. And so they matter to us more, the things that we hold in print. And you're seeing this affect many different forms. And so you look at direct marketing, for example, and physically mailing people stuff, and how dramatically that has gone down, and how because of that, you know, it's actually in some categories, it's much easier to stand out now with direct marketing because nobody else does it anymore. And so you think about the opportunity of that, and something that, you know, by any marketer's standard would be considered an old tactic, or at least old school. You know, like mailing people stuff is been around for a long time, but a lot of marketers have abandoned it. And so therefore, you know, maybe that's something you should bring back into your marketing strategy, because you have the ability to make it, depending on how you do it. I mean, if it's a throwaway postcard, it's hard to call that precious. But if you do something that's beautifully packaged and send it to the right people, you have the opportunity for it to matter much more than maybe it did in the past.
A similar, I don't know if it's a trend or not, but in the sales world, there's this even greater reluctance to call your prospects. And I've spoken to some authors of sales books on this podcast, and they say, this is the best time ever to be calling people because no one seems to want to pick up the phone. Now, it doesn't mean that that's the first contact you have with a prospect, but just picking up the phone and calling them, apparently all these sales folks are saying it's just like print. No one else is doing it.
Yeah, I mean, you think about the power of – I mean, I'm still one of those guys that does a lot of handwritten notes, and I physically send them to people. And just the power of that and how much people appreciate it now is amazing.
Yeah, and I tell that to people who are looking for jobs, people my kids' age or college students and so forth. I tell them stories about how rare and what a big impact a handwritten note has. So if we could just go back to a couple of the older trend reports, I wanted to ask you if you could explain the concept of the reluctant marketer trend from 2015.
Yeah, the reluctant marketer was based around a lot of conversation that was happening in the marketing industry that's still happening now around the new and evolved role of the marketing person or the chief marketing officer in particular versus what it used to be. And in particular, this idea that the marketer or the person who's running marketing now has to be across innovation and new product development. They have to be across customer care and customer service because so much of that can now happen on social media and is public as opposed to private. And sales and the intersection with sales and sales opportunity and content marketing and lead generation. And so marketing as a field used to be something that was much more constrained and is now reaching into these many, many other areas of business in such a way that you had more and more marketing leaders saying, look, I don't want to be the chief marketing officer anymore. I want to be the chief customer officer or the chief innovation officer or the chief creative officer. And so there was this evolution where nobody wanted to call it marketing anymore. Everybody wanted to call it, you know, a content studio or some other term that made it something bigger than marketing, because that's what their roles were actually evolving into.
From practice and the perception of being more about just promotion.
Right.
And I think it's also connected to this. I don't know. Again, I don't know if it's a trend, but the idea of you're starting to see more CMOs become CEOs, because in their role as CMO, the head marketing person, just like you talked about, you know, the customer experience and having to go into all the different silos, they are then familiar with which levers to pull to get more revenue, and you're seeing them go into the CEO role, whereas in the past it might have been maybe somebody from accounting and finance, or before that it was maybe from the manufacturing end.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right.
So just the last question from the 2016 report, can you explain the branded utility trend?
Yeah, branded utility was, for me, kind of the perfect way of describing what I try and do when it comes to trends. Because at the time when I wrote that, everyone was talking about content marketing. And the big idea was, let's create more content. Everything has to be content. If you're not doing content, your marketing is going to fail. And for me, the elevated idea behind that was, let's try and be useful for people and create value and create utility. And then let's brand it in a way that brings back value to our brand, as opposed to just throwing stuff out there. And branded utility was my way of describing this elevated idea in a way that went beyond just creating content. Because one of the points that I would make when I would do a keynote talk and mention this was, you know, if you went to James Cameron, the filmmaker, and asked him about his epic movies and about making, you know, Titanic or making Avatar, the last thing he would do is describe his movies as content, right? I mean, gifted creators and people like that don't call their stuff content. Picasso didn't call his paintings content, right?
not that we know, yeah.
Yeah, right. And so, like, we slap this word on it and we say, oh, we need poets and artists and journalists and all these people to work in marketing. And then we stick them in these marketing roles and we say, create some content. And these people say, look, we're storytellers. We create stories and we create engagement. And sometimes it's going to have a brand angle and maybe sometimes it won't. But what we're not going to do is create crap content. And so, you know, I sort of saw this pushback against the idea of content being what we should focus on, in the same way that kind of social doesn't really describe social media anymore, because there's lots of quote unquote social media, which is basically just media. It's stories that are going out there, and the social side of it, which is by definition commentary and conversation, sometimes happens and sometimes doesn't. I mean, you turn off comments on YouTube videos because all the comments are usually stupid and racist and moronic. So why would you want that sort of quote unquote conversation? It doesn't add any value for the world, doesn't add any value for your brand. So skip it. I mean, I'm a pretty, as you can tell, I'm a pretty opinionated guy when it comes to like what I think is useful or not. I'm not a, oh, you could do this, you could do that.
But you're very nice about it, Rohit.
I try not to be an asshole. Yes.
Well, it goes with the nice guy, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It is on my business card.
That's right.
So I have to live up to it.
That's right. It's a promise you're making. So, Rohit, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
I think it would be train yourself to observe more around you. That's kind of the main point behind being a trend curator and behind Non-Obvious, which is train your observational muscle. You know, don't walk down the street looking at your phone. Pick your head up. Buy magazines that aren't targeted towards you. I mean, that is what we really want people to do.
So what books have inspired your work and career?
I read a lot of different books, and my answer is often the same as what Isaac Asimov said when a reporter asked him of the more than 100 books he'd written, which one was his favorite. And he said, not even jokingly, the last one I've written.
Oh, that's right. You mentioned that in the book.
Yeah, because he's, you know, he just read so many different things. He's written so many different things, and his inspiration shifts, right? And so for me, like, my inspiration is shifted. And I actually just published a list of 15 books that I found amazingly valuable this past year. And the book that I put at the top of the list, there's a couple of different categories. So actually, I mentioned Martin's book, Small Data, in there as well.
We'll make sure to include a link to that post in the show notes.
Yeah, I think your listeners will love
it. Yeah.
It's 15 books, and it's just that I thought were really valuable. But the one that I rated as most important over the past year, which is one of the categories, was a book called Persuadable. And the reason why I really enjoyed that book was the whole idea of the book was, if you're going to be a gifted leader, you have to be willing to change your mind. And I think that was such an interesting, simple idea that not enough of us talk about, because all of us talk about like, okay, you're going to be a leader, you're going to create this stuff, and it's all got to come from inside, and it's very self-motivated. But how many of us really think about how persuadable am I? Like, if I heard someone arguing for the thing that I disagree with, how willing would I be to change my mind?
Yeah. And is there also an issue of, you know, don't want to show that I'm weak by changing my mind?
There's lots of issues behind changing your mind, right? There's lots of reasons why you wouldn't. Maybe you're just sure that you're right. Mm-hmm. Maybe you don't want to appear bad because you want to change your mind. Maybe you don't want to – I mean, there's lots and lots of reasons to not do it, right? But I have hardly ever seen someone arguing for the virtues of being persuadable. And so that as an idea, I just really, really liked.
Oh, wow. Well, we'll make sure to include a link to your post, and then I assume that's going to have a link to those – those books elsewhere.
It does, yeah.
Okay. So are there any other recent or upcoming books that you recommend or looking forward to reading?
I have one that is coming out the same day as mine, which is Tim Ferriss's new book. I think it's called like Tools of Titans or something like that. And he's a friend of mine. And I like the way that he thinks about the world, because he's a very analytical guy, to a point that not a lot of people would even consider. I mean, the guy kept workout diaries of his own workouts for 10 years straight, and not many people would do that. So he takes that methodology and really applies it to this concept of the minimum viable effort, right? So like, what is the minimum amount of work you could do in the minimum amount of time to learn how to speak the minimum amount of Mandarin to get by in China, for example? You know, and his whole kind of method is around that in every space: language, career, weightlifting, body weight loss, you know, like everything.
Podcasting,
book launching, I mean, everything. And so that point of view is just so broad and so interesting that I always find that I take some value from anything that he puts out there.
Oh, absolutely. How can you not pay attention to him? Now I'm going to have to read his book too. So,
well, part of the training.
Yeah, right? That's right. Well, it's a pleasure to do it. Rohit, how best can listeners learn more about you and your book?
Best way is probably just to visit my website, which is my full name, so rohitbhargava.com. And obviously, the books are available kind of everywhere, and they should be available in retail and airport bookstores and all that stuff for the next few months as well.
Oh, so great. Well, we'll make sure to include a link to your, not just to that one post, but also to your homepage at marketingbookpodcast.com. Also, I want to mention, can you tell the listener how they can subscribe to your newsletter and get the sneak peek at the 2018 trend research before it's available publicly?
Yeah. So what I do is every week I publish a weekly newsletter on Thursday mornings that includes the 5 underappreciated marketing stories of the week. And so I'm finding things that I consider to be non-obvious, not the main story that everybody read about already, but things that you might have missed from many different parts of the world. And so my subscribers get one email from me every week on Thursday mornings, Eastern time, with that. And then they also get a sneak peek at the new trend report before it comes out. And so in this case, it would be, you know, I gave them a peek of the 2017 report, and the next year it'll be the 2018 report. And the best way to subscribe there is just go to my website, rohitbhargava.com/subscribe, or you should find links from there on the homepage to do that as well.
Okay, and we'll make sure to include a link to that as well. The name of the book is Non-Obvious 2017 Edition, How to Think Different, Curate Ideas, and Predict the Future. The author is Rohit Bhargava. Rohit, thank you very much for being on the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you for having me, Douglas.
And that closes the book on episode 104 of the Marketing Book Podcast. But please don't let the end of this episode be the end of what you can learn about modern marketing. Visit marketingbookpodcast.com for links to all the things we talked about in this interview and free marketing guides from my agency. And while there, make sure to sign up for the Marketing Book Podcast newsletter so you never miss an episode. And if you're looking for a book recommendation or have a question or a guest suggestion, here's how to get in touch. Just go to marketingbookpodcast.com and send a message, or connect with me on LinkedIn. My name again is Douglas Burdett, or send me a tweet at my Twitter handle, marketing book. I'd love to hear from you. And please join us next time as we welcome Dr. Carmen Simon to the show to talk about her book, Impossible to Ignore, Creating Memorable Content to Influence Decisions. Thanks again for listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.